Hello and welcome to the Mega Smeralda and our third Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. Finally, the tour is underway, and today we'll talk about stage one, won by Marcel Kittel, but not after some unexpected drama, not to say farce, in the closing stages. A bit like the peloton that contested today's finish, we're slightly diminished in numbers today, but not in quality, as I'm joined by the Marcel Kittel of podcasting, Daniel Free. And I'm Richard Moore, and we're going to cover some of the talking points from today and play a brief interview with Sir Dave Brailsford, team principal at Team Sky, in which he discusses the team that's been selected to support the favourite, Chris Froome. Okay, Daniel, hello.
Good evening, Richard. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. We are diminished in numbers, but let's try and make up for that with some quality banter. And we, you know, there's lots to talk about today, but we'll get on to the bus that blocked the finish later on, because I think you've got some exclusive information on that.
I'm not sure about exclusive, but...
Well, it's exclusive at the moment. Yeah, by the time this podcast is broadcast, it may no longer
be
exclusive.
News, yeah.
But let's paint a picture of the start today. I didn't make it to the start, unfortunately. Some of the logistical challenges in Corsica mean it's difficult to get to the start. But you were at the start. What was that like?
Well, I think everyone's been struck the last couple of days by how sort of quaint it's all been. Porto Vecchio, very, very small, almost a village, a fishing village. I mean, it's quite developed from a tourist point of view now, but... And that was where the start was this morning. Not an awful lot of people, very low-key, you know, could have been...
To the Mediterranean,
it could have been. And, you know, very easy access to all the buses. That's been a problem, certainly, in the last few years. Sometimes you get, you know, crowds four or five deep, even around the buses in the morning. It was very, very easy to move around and do your job this morning. It was good.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I guess this is what they would have expected, quite a low-key Grand Départ, because it is a difficult island to get to, and I'm sure that a lot of people who want to see the tour will join up with the race on the mainland, just because it's far easier to get around. Normally on the route you see hundreds and hundreds of camper vans. I haven't seen any at all.
I think I
saw one or two today. Jürgen Vandenbroek's family, I think, are the only people I've seen on the route.
No devil. Is that right?
I haven't seen him.
Didn't he miss it last year because he was ill?
I think you're right, actually, yeah.
But, I mean, this is perhaps doesn't apply so much to the stages in Corsica because, for reasons you just outlined there. But I do feel that the Tour really needs a... We've said it many times over the last few years. I think it really needs a major French contender to, you know, kind of up the ante in terms of the French crowds. It was interesting, there was a big piece in L'Equipe today about Thibaut Pinot. Pretty unanimously they did a survey of current French riders, asked maybe half a dozen of them, and pretty unanimously they all said that he has the potential to be the next French Tour winner. You know, there have been endless next Bernard Hinos, in the same way there have been endless Diego Maradonas in, you know, Argentine footballers, etc., etc. But there is a feeling that he certainly has the talent to do that, then, you know, it'd be fantastic. From the public's point of view, the crowds, I'm sure, would come out in their hundreds of thousands.
I mean, is there something deliberate about the fact that it is quite low-key, the 100th Tour? Is there a sort of rebooting of the Tour, in a sense, after... You know, the Armstrong years represented something, you took the Tour into a whole different kind of sphere in terms of profile, impact, the star-studdedness around it, the glitz around it, the glamour, the Hollywood sort of flavour to it that was evident during the Armstrong years. Is there almost a deliberate kind of getting away from that, a distancing?
I don't think so, really. The gigantisme, they talk about the gigantisme of the Tour, the... You know, what's the English word for that, Rich? Gigantisme.
Gigantism.
Gigantism, I suppose, yeah. And mondialisation is another one they use a lot, isn't it? The kind of globalisation of the
Tour. French your first language, Daniel? you're asking for translation.
It might be.
That's just...
Showboating of the highest order.
Absolutely.
But no, I think it's quite coincidental. I mean, this is something that they've been working on for 6 years, Prudhomme. Had the idea to take the Tour to Corsica. It was obviously a bit of an anomaly in the Tour's history, the fact they'd never been, and, you know, let's not forget that this is part of France here.
And another low-key start next year in Yorkshire.
No, I think next year will be huge,
I'm only joking. It will be gigantic. But the start this morning, was there anything... it's always unusual as well when the tour begins with a road stage rather than a prologue time trial, I think. There's not the same... The prologue time trial does act as a kind of curtain raiser, doesn't it? Yeah. It does set the scene quite nicely.
Yeah, there's certainly more ceremony about a prologue time trial than there is about a road stage. Mm. And you know, you really feel the tension and the nerves of the riders. Today, everyone seemed fairly relaxed.
Some riders, a contingent of riders, met with the French sports minister. Was there any chat about that? It really, I don't know if this meeting was arranged prior to the Lance Armstrong interview, which raised again the doping issue, but I think it was more concerned with this report that's coming out about 1998.
Yeah, as I understand it, Jérôme Pino is one of the key spokesmen of this, a certain movement among the French riders. They do not want, I think at the moment, the French Senate is due to release a list of the riders who supposedly tested positive in 1998 or tested positive in retrospective tests for EPO, and that list is supposed to come out on the day of the Alpe d'Huez, the 18th of July. And Jérôme Pino has been very vocal, and he's spoken to the French sports minister asking for that announcement to be delayed, because he says, look, you have to appreciate that we are a different generation, cycling has moved on, and it's really not fair that this continues to happen.
Interestingly, Jens Voigt was one of the people that met. Was he arguing that he's part of a new generation as well? 41 years old.
But the French, they have met with a French sports minister, and she has given her support, but it's not her decision, ultimately.
Okay, don't worry, we're going to come onto the bus in a minute. Not literally get onto the bus, but we will discuss the bus in the next segment.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
I'm Richard Moore, and I'm with Daniel Freib, and we are talking about stage one of the 100th Tour de France. Now, Daniel,
Richard,
it was all pretty low key in keeping with the start in Corsica. You expect crashes. The only crash that happened early doors was Chris Froome in the neutralized zone. Now, it was a very minor scrape. You know, he seemed to hit a curb, but I think it was an advertising board or something.
Yeah.
And he came off. Now, it was minor. He was back up. He was back on, but are these the kind of things that happen to a rider that wins the Tour? I mean, it, let's not overplay it, but...
Well, we said that at the Giro, didn't we? We said after a few days that Wiggins was getting dropped. He was. You could explain it in two different ways. You could have said, oh, well, he's just been unlucky. He's just on the wrong end of splits that are happening. But actually, you're absolutely right. These things don't tend to
happen. There aren't many splits in the neutralised zone usually.
No.
I don't think he was on the wrong end of a split. No. But, I remember 2011, Alberto Contador was the big favourite of the Tour, despite having ridden the Giro and won the Giro. And he also suffered bad luck on that first day. He was held up by a crash, I think, rather than crashing himself. And it was just a kind of warning, a kind of early warning that all was not well for him. And again, with that kind of crash, it can be because you're in the wrong part of the bunch or whatever.
If that's true, they both had warnings that things were not well.
Well, Contador as well, obviously, had a warning. And Chris Froome did come through the big crash unscathed. Which now, let's talk through that final 10 kilometres. The bunch is 10 kilometres from the line.
12 kilometres, I understand.
What, when the crash happened?
Oh, yeah.
No, sorry. But the bunch was about 10 kilometres from the line when the cameras flashed to, I think Team Sky were the first to tweet the picture of the Orica Green Edge bus.
I mean, I understand that Jean-François Pecheur,
in case nobody is aware of this, was stuck on the finish line, wedged between the finish banner and the tarmac like a cork in a bottle. Stuck. Immovable.
Jean-François Pecheur, who's the competitions director, and the president of the race jury got word that this bus was stuck and there were 12 kilometres to go. They had a fairly hasty discussion, and they decided that the finish line would be moved to 3 kilometres to go, and which is the obvious place.
When we heard that decision, the camera flashed to 3 kilometres to go, and it was just after a roundabout.
Yeah,
it was bizarre.
I mean, it was the obvious place to put it, because that is, the transponder. It's set up for the transponders there. It's the only place, really, I think, where you can put it at such short notice. But as I understand it, they then made a decision, and with 10 kilometres to go, they informed that there's a separate individual, another guy who makes the announcements on race radio, and he had made the announcement in English, to the team directors. He'd made it in French, and he was in the middle of his announcement in Spanish when Pecher and the president of the race jury heard that actually the bus had now been moved. And they had another discussion, and then 3 kilometres later, so it was now 7 kilometres to go, they informed this guy who does the announcements again, and he informed the team manager. So they were more or less aware, most of them were aware at 7 kilometres to go that they were reversing to the original finish. And, you know, obviously, with 3 kilometres to go, we know, Rich, I mean, you look at a sprint train, most of the guys in a sprint train are... their designated role is to do between 2 kilometres and maybe, you know, for the last guy, 500 metres or 300 metres. So 3 kilometres makes a huge, huge difference, doesn't it?
It means there are much bigger sprint trains coming in, funneling into that finish. And the roads weren't particularly wide. It's interesting that you say that decision was at 7.5 kilometres.
Seven kilometres.
The crash happened about 6.5.
Yeah.
You also think that there's all this information coming into the riders' earpieces. That has to affect their concentration.
Yeah, and I think some had got the message loud and clear, and I think some knew exactly what was going on. Others had no idea. They heard their team director screaming in their ear. This Marcel Kittel, the eventual stage winner, was one of them.
Yeah, apparently he heard the finish is at the finish.
Right, okay.
Which probably didn't make an awful lot of sense.
No. So yeah, I think there was a lot of confusion. You know, no one will ever know, will ever be able to tell whether, you know, this shocking and changing had any effect on what came to pass, which were, you know, was that crash.
Mark Cavendish said afterwards that he felt that the chopping and changing was the cause of the crash. I think there's definitely a possibility that that's true. But at the same time, these kind of crashes are also inevitable in the first week of the tour. It was quite surprising that there hadn't been any really.
Yeah, and we drove in on that finish today. It wasn't the most complicated finish I've seen, but it certainly wasn't, you know, the kind of wide airport runway style finishes that Jean-Marie Leblanc used to favour when he was a tour director. It was more like a Giro finish, really. There were ups and downs. There were tended to be on single lane of a road rather than spread across the two lanes. So it was pretty gnarly.
So it took out a few of the fancied riders for the stage. Cavendish didn't come down. I think Tony Martin was the first rider down, and he's off to hospital with a suspected broken collarbone.
I think he's out.
He's out, yeah. I mean, if he's got a broken collarbone, unless he's Tyler Hamilton, which I don't think he is. Happened on the same stage, isn't it? The first proper road stage that Hamilton crashed, 2003.
Yeah.
But let's hope he's not Tyler Hamilton. He's out the race, which is a great pity for several reasons. It diminishes Cavendish's lead-out train. It destroys their team time trial hopes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it ruins his own hopes of the time trial stages in the race, one of which in particular he fancied. Andrew Greipel had his rear derailleur sheared off in the crash, and so he was stopped.
Rear derailleur?
Apparently.
French isn't your first language, is it, Rich?
how do you pronounce it? Go on, give me a lesson.
No. Come on, anyway, what were you saying? Go on, carry on.
His rear mech was sheared off, and he was left standing by the side of the road looking slightly dejected. Peter Sagan came off and seemed to be a little bit hurt in the crash.
I was actually quite surprised how sort of forcefully they came to the front, Cannondale, just before his crash, actually. Often in major tours and when races in general these days, a kind of resignation creeps in when Cavendish is right. And certainly when, you know, the three teams represented throughout the day at the front of the bunch were Lotto, Argos and Omega Pharma. I think there's a general perception, general acceptance that those guys may not be on an even footing, Kittel, Greipel and Cavendish, but they're certainly...
I remember, though, in 2009, when Milram had Gerald Chilak, who'd left HCC to join Milram, and the first couple of stages of the tour, they were fighting at the front, trying to assert some kind of authority. I think teams perhaps look at these first couple of stages as an effort to, as an opportunity, rather, to do something, send out a message and just... assert some kind of authority, and if it comes off, they're the sort of chosen ones, and they're allowed that extra space in future
days. Yeah, I mean, and some teams also have that luxury because Cannondale don't have a whole load of other objectives. They have Marina Moser, who's hoping to do a good first tour, but they can afford to dedicate 5 or 6 guys to Sagan.
back to the bus, because the bus eventually reversed. I don't know why they didn't reverse in the first place. I think they
let the tyres down.
Wow. Had the other team buses been through the finish? There was some confusion over whether that bus had not followed the proper evacuation from the course.
I think they had. The problem was that, so for most of the day, the finish arch is raised to a position which is, I think, the same height as motorway bridges in France. So all team buses would have been able to pass through quite comfortably. But there comes a point, I'm not sure how far the race is from the finish, but at a certain point they lower the arch, and it's mainly for aesthetic reasons. So the arch is actually in the picture on television. And it had been lowered, it was in its lowered position, and the bus was actually quite late getting to the finish.
They stopped for a barbecue, I think, on one of the beaches.
Usually they get to the finish the same time we get there, don't they? Yeah. They get to the finish 2-3 hours before the finish, but this was particularly late. And he should have stopped. He should have asked for authorisation. This is apparently the protocol. And there seems to be a bit of dispute over whether he did ask for and get authorisation from ASO. They say he didn't. Orica GreenEdge have claimed that he was waved through.
And there's a fake Twitter account being set up for the bus, which is already proving quite entertaining. So the winner, Marcel Kittel, it's unfortunate that his victory will be inevitably overshadowed by the farcical scenes on the finish line. But I think that, all that aside, he was certainly a deserving and worthy winner who would have been in the mix regardless, I think. He beat Cavendish and Greipel a couple of weeks ago. He would have been there or thereabouts, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they've certainly got a powerful lead out train now, haven't they? They've tended to sort of be very good between kind of kilometre, mine was sort of 4 and 1 to go, and then, you know, often they sort of lose the plot slightly in the last kilometre. But, you know, today it was obviously made a lot easier by, as soon as it's thinned out by a crash, it always becomes easier, doesn't it, for a team to really take control.
And he's a big, powerful sprinter, you know, give him a clear run at the line and he's going to win a lot of those kind of sprints.
That's their tour mate now.
But he's a popular first season, a popular yellow jersey, I think. He's a very approachable, likeable rider. So I think I think he's a good first yellow jersey. I don't imagine he will actually hold on to it tomorrow.
No, I think he might get dropped tomorrow.
He's one of the sprinters who may get dropped tomorrow, whereas somebody like Cavendish may hold on.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
We're going to play now a little interview that I did with Dave Brailsford a couple of days ago, just before the start of the tour. It's quite prescient in a way, because he talks about knowing that at some stage in the race they will lose a rider to a crash. And today they saw two of their men down. I think Stannard and Geraint Thomas both went down, not including Chris Froome's tumble in the neutralised zone. But Stannard and Thomas both went down. Geraint Thomas went off to hospital for x-rays. Apparently he's been given the all clear, so he's okay, but it was certainly a scare, and it does lend this interview with Dave Brailsford a prescient air. Dave, how important is experience at the Tour? Because the team you've got, there's some experienced riders, but there's not an awful lot of Tour experience, really.
Yeah, it's a good question, actually, because and we debated that for a long time and considered that for a long time. There's a physical capability in the team, for sure, but like you said, you know, you could question the level and depth of experience. And we took the decision in the end to select the team that we selected, obviously, so we obviously feel that this is the right team, otherwise we wouldn't have selected it. But I think it's a fair point, and if you went for the most experienced Tour de France team that you could get, it wouldn't be the team that we got here necessarily. So I think, you know, for Christian Knees, Bernie Eisel in particular, those two, I think, tough decision for them, you know, that they're not here.
You know, someone like Eisel especially brings other things, you know, I mean, I know he contributed a lot last year, and also his sort of standing status in the peloton, whether that counts for...
Yeah, we considered all of that, to be honest. I think this year's Tour, the bottom line is, I think we looked at versatility. And I think, you know, one thing we recognise is that the likelihood of losing a rider during this race is very high. So we know that potentially something's going to happen to one of our riders. We don't know who, we don't know when, but we know potentially it's going to happen. And then we think about the versatility of the team around them to make sure that actually we can still cover the most important elements of the race, which we consider to be climbing this year. And I think on the basis of that, that's why, you know, it's a very tough decision, but it's the decision that we went with. And you've got, you know, might not have the same level of experience they've got, but we've got a lot of guys who who are experienced, though. They're good bar riders, they're good racers. And I think, you know, team unity in terms of the harmony behind the goal is important, and communication and how people communicate, etc. And communicate with other teams and all the rest of it. You know, it's all important stuff. But
So who would you say is your kind of road captain? Is there somebody in the team?
I think Geraint would be the natural kind of guy. You know, but you've got a lot of experience in the likes of Lopez's experience now. He's a very experienced guy. He communicates well. I think Geraint really is the guy who naturally stands up and is the one to be counted, really.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Yeah, as you heard there, you're listening to the Tour de France podcast on humansinvent.com with myself, Richard Moore, and Daniel Freeb. And we've got a few things to plug on humansinvent.com in the next couple of weeks. There are articles going up by Graham O'Bree, Robert Penn, Tom Southam, and some films with Team Garmin Sharp as well. There's also some interesting prizes that we're going to be offering. We've got some signed Garmin Sharp kits and some Sharp products as well. And we're going to have a wee think about competition questions and maybe launch that competition tomorrow, Sunday. There's also, humansinvent.com are also going to be offering some very odd prizes in the next 3 weeks. There's an opportunity to win in week one a phone call from Jonathan Vauters, the general manager of the team. And in week two, a phone call from David Miller. And in week three, a phone call from somebody else, possibly Dan Martin.
What is the nature of these phone calls?
What's the nature of the phone call? Like, just a phone call, just a chat.
All right.
From somebody at the tour. I mean,
who calls who?
That's a good... Well, I think they'll make the call.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's a block number, withheld number. Yeah. They're like that, aren't they? They always do that.
Yeah.
Cavendish is the worst for that.
Oh, terrible. Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if it's a block number, so don't expect to get any mobiles through this. But, you know, just have a chat about the tour. Ask whatever you want.
Yeah.
It's an interesting and unusual and very original prize. And I think it's...
Never to be repeated.
Possibly. Possibly never to be repeated. David Miller, though, fourth today in the bunch sprint. A remarkable performance by him.
Wow. Was it really remarkable?
He keeps reinventing himself. He was a classics rider a couple of years ago. He's going to be taking on Mark Cavendish tomorrow.
It is a bit of a mystery. So in order to finish fourth, he obviously had to be very near the front when the crash happened. Not many guys got through that crash, did they?
No.
So he was obviously there for... I'm not quite sure why he was up that far up the front. I mean,
just avoiding trouble, perhaps.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. I went to see Jonathan Vauters yesterday briefly in the Garmin Sharp team hotel. Very nice hotel they were staying in, actually. And interestingly,
I thought you were going to say very nice guy then.
Lovely four-star hotel on the edge of Porto Vecchio.
Yeah.
Also staying there were Pat McQuaid and Brian Cookson,
right,
both running to be UCI president at the moment. I think that the advice to Brian Cookson was to stay at the bar. But he was slightly nervous, I think, about the prospect of sharing a hotel with Pat McQuaid, because their battle to become next president of the UCI has turned...
It's turned nasty
...pretty
already,
sour.
Hasn't it?
They've always been, you know, certainly quite close colleagues, and Cookson has always been pretty an ally, I think, of McQuaid's.
Yeah.
Turned pretty nasty the last few weeks. Some fairly odd messages coming out of the UCI office from Pat McQuaid. I think we've kind of segued into discussion of this now, but Brian Cookson is pushing quite hard for Pat McQuaid to reveal exactly how much he earns through his position as president of the UCI, and that Pat McQuaid's obvious embarrassment of that and reluctance to release those details suggests that there could be something there that might swing the vote in favour of Brian Cookson. Who knows? Anyway, Jonathan Vauters did say last night that he was feeling confident, but he wasn't entirely sure why. I think they've come to this tour with a team of riders who, they don't have an obvious leader, I don't think, and they've got a team of some young riders, some experienced riders, and there are various opportunities that could open up to them over the course of the tour. You know, Andrew Talansky is making his debut, Dan Martin is one for the mountains. Ryder Hesjedal, who was caught up in the crash today, actually.
Yeah.
Who knows what he could be capable of here. So I think that he sees lots of different opportunities and isn't quite sure which, if any, will come off.
Yeah, Hesjedal's really the forgotten man, isn't he, of the tour? Not mentioned in any previews, really. Lequipe today did a a spread on maybe the top six, seven contenders. Again, not mentioned at all, even in dispatches.
That I was, Lekeep did their usual sort of, you know, ranking of the contenders.
Star rating.
Yeah, I mean, Froome was the only five-star contender. I think Contador was on four. I was quite surprised at how it dropped off after those two. I mean, well, I wasn't surprised, but it kind of underlined, you know, just how much of a pedestal those two guys are on in terms of how we're looking at how this tour will shake out. And I was quite surprised to see, I think Cadel Evans was on two stars and TJ Van Garderen was only on one.
I thought there was something revealing in the closing stages today. BMC did the usual thing of surging to the front as soon as there was any hint of trouble, and that is something that happens on Cadel's initiative. He's always someone who puts a lot of pressure on his domestiques to be right at the front whenever there's any sniff of any trouble. I'm not aware of Van Garderen running in the same fashion. I think it still is Cadel very much calling the shots.
He made it clear yesterday, Friday, that he was the sole leader of the team.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, he is 36 now, isn't he?
Cadel
Evans. I think we've thought he was in decline. He rode well in the Giro, but I don't think we can really think that he's a potential winner of the Tour. He was saying that his ambition was a podium, but you know, I would have thought if I was in charge of that team, I'd be wanting to put TJ Van Garderen on the podium because he's clearly one for the future. So I'm quite surprised at that. And I think there is an element we've talked a bit about, you know, passive aggressiveness of certain other riders. And there is something a little bit strange about Cadel Evans, isn't there? I think that even more having read Charlie Wegelius's excellent.
You've only just realised.
No, but it's been. There was a great little episode in Charlie Wegelius's book Domestique, which is a very revealing book about life as a domestique, and he spoke about being signed by Cadel Evans' team, which was, I think, Silence Lotto at the time, in 2007, and he went for it. The idea was that he was to be Evans' lieutenant in the mountains, you know, one of his key guys on the climbs, and he went for dinner with Cadel Evans and his wife Chiara. Charlie went with his wife, and Evans brought a very expensive bottle of wine along to the meal, which sat on the table all night and remained unopened over what was apparently quite an awkward dinner, and then he took the wine bottle away with him again at the end of the night. Just quite strange. Interesting that he should include that in his book. Just finally, to wrap this up, we mentioned Lekeep. Last year they declared their greatest ever sprinter to be Mark Cavendish. This year the magazine Today has convened a panel of experts, chaired by Thomas Voeckler, actually.
Yeah.
Members of the panel included Mark Sargeant, oddly, Bernardino, Christian Prudhomme, a couple of journalists, and they were there to discuss who they thought was the greatest ever climber. And they seem to have come down on the side of Federico Bahamontes, the Spanish climber of the 50s.
Slightly odd, wasn't it? And even more odd was, I think,
well,
the guy they chose in second place
was Richard Veronque.
It's completely baffling.
It's a strange one. How can, especially with all that's gone on recently,
here's
the poster boy of the greatest doping scandal until Armstrong, you know, the Festina affair of 1998. He did win the King of the Mountains lots of times, but I don't. There's no question now, but
And interestingly, Bahamontes was always one of his most strident critics, wasn't he? Veronque. He always used to say that he wasn't the best climber in any tour, and he was just an opportunist. And you know, a lot of Veronque's mountain points came via sprints at the top of second and third cats.
He wasn't even as if we're to ignore the fact that he was a poster boy for the EPO generation, then why not Marco Pantani?
Well, exactly.
I mean, Pantani was a far more electrifying climber,
and Charlie Gall as well. I'm quite surprised that
Lucien Van Impe was in the list as well. Someone like Luis Herrera as well from the 80s was a tremendously exciting climber to watch.
Luis Ocaña.
Just a pure climber. Ocaña was there as well. But that was a strange one, I felt. Odd sort of message to come out of the journal of the tour on the eve of the 100th tour. Very strange. Is Veronque still, I mean, he's on Eurosport, isn't he? Is he pop, does he remain quite
still
popular?
Still mincing about. He's fronting a an advertising campaign for Festina, isn't he, at the moment? Which I can't work out whether it's tongue-in-cheek or not. Do you think it is? I mean, Festina's re-involvement in cycling, which is obviously, you know, a very good thing. Festina UK are also involved. But it's difficult to work out to what extent it is slightly tongue-in-cheek. And they're certainly still benefiting greatly, you know, afraid to say, from the involvement in the scandal in 1998, because they're always, you know, it doesn't necessarily reflect negatively on the brand, but they're constantly mentioned.
Absolutely. I mean, the Festina affair, I mean, the name recognition is
and it
huge.
Doesn't reflect negatively on the brand, does it?
Well, it's just a bit like the Orica Green Edge bus today. I mean, you know, what a great bit of publicity. That photograph will be beamed around the world. An awful lot more people will know about Orica Green Edge than they did before today.
Yeah.
And that they probably would have done it by the end of the tour. Who knows? They're a kind of sort of misfiring team a little bit, aren't they, Orica Green Edge?
Yeah, they really need a good tour, and I don't necessarily think they're going to have one.
It's not a great omen. It wasn't a great omen to do.
No, and you know, Matt Goss, totally independently of that.
When will he be famous?
Well, when will he be famous? But he came a bit of a cropper in the closing stages. But, you know, they have a problem with their two main riders. Certainly their main earners are Gerrans and Goss, and both of them are extremely good riders, but not necessarily the best at what they do, their particular speciality. In Gerrans' case, you know, a kind of puncher, very good on the short, steep climbs, but, you know, probably not as fast as Peter Sagan.
No.
Not as good on difficult finishes as Philippe Gilbert.
Gerrans isn't so much one for Monday, which is quite a tough stage, and will favour those kind of riders as an opportunist when in the, you know, on a transition stage later in the tour. I don't think we'll see him contesting.
And it's hard to see what Goss is going to get out of this tour, because he's, you know, he's perhaps the fifth or sixth fastest sprinter in the race, and he's not any climb that he gets over, and guys like Kittel and Greipel don't. Sagan will also get over, and I would argue that Sagan is probably the faster finisher now. So.
Right, on that note, we'll end tonight's podcast. Slightly rambling final segment there, but never mind. Our numbers will be bolstered tomorrow. We're lining up some exciting international
big
guests.
Names tomorrow.
Big names. Some of them humble, actually.
Yeah, some of them native French speakers.
Oh, possibly. Oh, my God. Well, they might help Daniel with some of the translations. And on Tuesday, we'll be rejoined by our old chum, Lionel, who is in a field in Glastonbury enjoying the festivities before coming across the tour. So thank you very much for listening once again to the Tour de France podcast with humansevent.com, and we will speak to you again tomorrow.